We were originally asked by Wendy Leckie in Dell to make a contribution to this seminar, and we had completed a report last summer for Dell, and the initial expectation is we might run through the report with you, but no. Well, we decided that probably wasn't the best approach, and what we thought might be more useful is to give you a sort of top-level, top-line sketch of some of the key issues around higher education participation, who gets in, the migration issue, rather than a very detailed analysis, trip through a large, substantial survey. So that's what we've decided to do. And it will be a joint presentation. I'll do the first bit, and then I'll hand over to Tony. So what we're simply going to do is have a look at patterns of entry, particularly have a look at the age participation index, have a look at the characteristics of who goes into higher education, social characteristics, and look at the widening access indicators, and then look at the, in many ways, what is the main bone of contention around higher education policy here, and that is the staying-leaving equation and the debate over places. Should there be more places, fewer places? And why do people go? Do they go voluntarily? Are they forced? And so on, which is probably the biggest part of the participation debate here. And we're going to focus on full-time undergraduates. There isn't time to unpack for part-timers and postgraduates and so on. And we're going to draw upon official data sources and some survey evidence to illuminate what we're talking about. First thing to say is that Northern Ireland has not adopted the English measure of participation, which is the Higher Education Initial Participation Index. The focus in England shifted to some form of participation in higher education for those aged 18 to 30, with the ambition of raising that rate to 50%. Northern Ireland has not adopted that. Therefore, the old measure, which was the Age Participation Index, is the one that is still, if you like, the relevant one. It's not the only way in which you want to look at participation, but it's the basic participation rate which is still used here. And in the figure there, I show the change over time since 89-90. And you can see that around the year 2000, 99-2000, roughly about there, it has more or less settled. The last figure on the graph is a provisional figure. It may well edge up slightly when the final figure is put in. So what we've had in Northern Ireland is an age participation index of 18 to 21-year-olds as a proportion of 18-year-olds, which is the basic measure, which has been fairly steady around the mid-40s, 44, 45, 46, 47, minor fluctuations for a year. So in policy terms, you know, what was the point in redefining the whole thing and going for 50% when we're more or less there? So I think that's the most important point about participation. We have high participation here, and we've had it for quite a long time. Then we look at the breakdown, some simple breakdowns. The gender balance is quite markedly in favour of females. And there's a number of factors behind that. Girls started outperforming boys leaving school in about, I think if I remember rightly, 1992, 93. Parity was reached, and then shortly afterwards, the changeover began. Some of us like to point to the ending of the discrimination in the 11 plus that took place about 1987, Tony, was it, 88? When the way in which the 11 plus worked was they divided boys and girls into separate populations and took the best performers within the two populations. But since girls were doing so much better, it meant that a lot of boys were being offered a grammar school place who had performed less well than a lot of girls. So when you put the two populations together, instead of dropping the boys out, they offered lots more places to girls. And that, I think, is a sort of basic underpinning. The second thing that, of course, has changed is what counts as higher education. And as soon as you included nursing in higher education, with a bias there in terms of a subject which women take up, that has also added to it. So you've had those three elements: the correcting of the discrimination in the 11 plus, the improving performance of women, and then the sorts of subjects that are defined as higher education. But that is quite a significant imbalance now, 58-42. The other thing that is quite interesting is on the age distribution. As you can see, we're still dominated by 18 to 21-year-olds, or 18 to 20-year-olds going into higher education, and that mature entrants, and especially the older mature entrants, it's not defined in terms of anything other than chronology, of course, down at 6%. And that is quite a significant change over the years. I was recalling with a colleague the other day about the educating Rita phenomenon that we used to have. Quite significant working class women getting into their early 40s had had their children very young. They were off. They were going into higher education. And if the husband was okay, that's fine. But if he's not, you can do without him as well. But they're gone. We don't see those in higher education at all. And I think the whole issue of mature participation, certainly in full-time undergraduate education, is an issue now. Part-time is a different matter, but certainly the funding regime that now exists, I think it must be a significant inhibitor of mature entry. Now, the religion figures are derived from a separate source. They're derived from the school leavers survey, and there must be an element of doubt. First of all, they leave out those going into FE, HE and FE. So we're looking at HE in the universities. But the higher proportion of Catholics, or Catholics make up the majority of those going to higher education, in part that's made up of two things. One, the demography, past demography, which was significantly higher birth rates for Catholics. And secondly, participation. And we do know that participation, particularly in working class Protestant communities, is very low. So we've got the demography plus participation producing that figure. If you unpack the 8%, there are various forms of people, of groupings that would, in one definition, be included in Protestant, but for a variety of reasons, they aren't. So the 38 is probably a bit bigger. But anyway, that's the basic outline. In terms of widening access, in terms of who's getting into higher education in Northern Ireland, well, the state schools issue is not a Northern Ireland, well, the public school issue, I suppose you'd call it, is not an issue here. We don't have public schools as such. So that bar chart is actually quite interesting because it just stops short of being 100%. It's about 99.9%. So somebody from a public school is rattling around Northern Ireland. I need a one-person focus group to find out who he or she is and why they're there. But because we don't have a public school sector as such, it's not an issue. And you can see that to the extent that it is an issue, it's in other parts of the United Kingdom, and we do know that it's certain universities in particular within the UK, Oxbridge. The key groups now regarded for policy terms in terms of widening access are the socioeconomic groups 4 to 7. And you can see the figures there. We have consistently, in the two Northern Ireland universities, been consistently above the HEFCE or the HESA benchmarks. And have consistently been doing so for a long time. Now, in part, that's made up of a number of things. First of all, the Northern Ireland socioeconomic structure of the population shows larger proportions in 4 to 7 than other parts of the UK, so there's a sort of basic underlying structural element to it. Second, as Tony will point out in a minute, we have got differential migration. Those who leave are drawn from the higher socioeconomic groups rather than the lower socioeconomic groups, or to a greater extent. And then thirdly, I suppose you could also attribute it to the activities of the universities in helping to sustain those figures. So there are a number of underlying reasons why Northern Ireland figures look so good. But do they look so good? If you unpack 4 to 7 by the individual groups, what we don't do in either university, and I think this is something HEFCE is starting to focus on in England, is the very deprived communities in inner city areas. They're not so well represented. So the amalgamation of 4 to 7 hides a number of issues and problems, and that becomes more apparent when I turn to the next slide and look at low participation in neighbourhoods. But I think it's also worth pointing to the Scottish situation, because that's a bit out of line with England and Wales. I wrote a paper about 7 or 8 years ago pointing this out, post-Deering. Well, I suppose it's 10 years ago now, isn't it? Post-Deering, which got me into a lot of trouble with the Scottish universities, because I pointed out that you could argue that the Scottish universities were basically saying widening access is an FE issue, and it's got nothing to do with us. Certain people thought that was a good idea, but certainly the heads of the Scottish universities weren't impressed. And since it came out of a Universities UK project, I had to go and account to them about why I took that view. But there is an issue in Scotland about saying that FE provides local, accessible, further and higher education to deprived communities. And what you then have to do is get articulation from FE into higher education. Now, Jim Gallagher in Glasgow Caledonian has researched this quite extensively, and he says the articulation isn't particularly successful. So it's all very well having a strategy which says, let's leave it up to FE, but then you don't have the routes particularly well oiled or particularly well signposted, then you end up with a situation where the universities aren't picking up people from diverse backgrounds particularly well. Now, the low participation neighbourhoods data picks out this relative underachievement of Northern Ireland quite well. At our university, at the University of Ulster, we've done a little bit of work on this. I'm not sure if you've done the same, Tony. What we're doing is picking up people from relatively poor backgrounds from small towns and rural areas. We're not picking them up from the inner city. If it was clearer, you could look out, and I would draw some areas for you down there, and we ain't getting them from there. So what looks like a top line as a very successful situation has certain weaknesses within it. And again, when you look at Scotland, they're even worse than us. Not a great deal I can say about the DSA, that's Entitlement to Disability Student Allowance, as the main measure. We both measure that and self-reported disability, and there is no strong relationship between the two. Certainly, the whole issue about people with disabilities being prepared to identify themselves as having a disability, which they have to do to get a DSA, versus the actual number of people with disabilities, we actually think the self-reporting measure is a better one, although it isn't represented in the indicators, because people have a disability but don't necessarily want to go and say, I've got a disability, therefore I want you to do the X, Y, and Z. And the tension between those two measures is, I think, means the DSA measure has some problems. I would say that, wouldn't I, maybe, because the Northern Ireland figure is a bit lower. But certainly if we were to take a self-reported measure, we would be, certainly at the University of Ulster, we on self-reported disability, we're picking up 10 to 11% of students with one form of disability or another. I'm doing. That's you, Tony.
Okay, thanks, Bo. I just want to pick up on the other issue we identified at the start as an issue that's been a lot of policy discussion, debate here in Northern Ireland. This is to do with the issue of migration. It's the number of, and the proportion of Northern Ireland students who leave Northern Ireland to go to university, mainly to England or Wales. And the graph here shows the sort of the basic pattern over a period of time, with the majority of students staying in the one or other of the Northern Ireland institutions, but a significant proportion going to institutions largely in England or Wales, and England and Scotland, with a smaller proportion going to institutions in the Republic. What you can see from the graph is that up to the end of the 1980s, the proportion of leavers to England and Scotland was going steadily up and peaked at around about 40%, but since that time has declined and is currently stabilised at around about 25-26%. Why those patterns happened and what were the sort of factors that motivated young people to make these decisions have been subject to a lot of debate and discussion. Some evidence we have from surveys in the past suggests that there's some distinctive characteristics among the leavers. Relatively small extent, the leavers, there's a slightly higher proportion of men and women included among the leavers. From a statistical point of view, the other two factors are perhaps a little bit more significant in that young people from the higher social groups and Protestants are disproportionately represented among the leavers. And given that so much sort of policy debate in Northern Ireland is heavily informed or influenced by sectarian realities, then obviously that's a factor that provoked a lot of discussion and comment as well as to why so many young Protestants were leaving. Encouraged also, and the discussion was also informed by the fact that for quite a while a high proportion of the people who left never came back. They went over and settled in GB. So those are sort of the patterns and the characteristics of the leavers. Again, work we did in the past has tried to get some sort of a handle on the different groups that were involved among the leavers. And what we concluded after quite a bit of work was that there are two distinct groups. We called them reluctant leavers and determined leavers. The reluctant leavers were young people who, in a sense, felt they were pushed out. The sort of courses they wanted to do had very high entry levels, largely because of demand factors. And so although many of these young people told us that they would quite like to stay, they were finding it very difficult to get onto courses in Northern Ireland. And then there were a number of other factors which encouraged them, on top of that, which encouraged them to take up options in other places. So that was the reluctant leavers. And alongside this, there was a very distinctive group of determined leavers who'd made a conscious choice to go. They wanted to see something different, experience something different, to escape from the sort of the stultifying atmosphere of Northern Ireland and experience other things. And so these people were making a conscious decision to leave. So the first group were, in a sense, pushed out. The second group were pulled out by the attraction of the opportunities they saw in front of them. What seems to have happened more recently is that the number of places in the Northern Ireland institutions in higher education has increased as the cap on numbers has been lifted a little bit. And as that has increased, the number of reluctant leavers has declined, because as reluctant leavers, when they're given an opportunity to stay, large numbers of them seem actually to stay. So over time, the change in circumstance has reduced the proportion of reluctant leavers as places have become available. And so part of the reason for the decline from the 40% to the 25% of leavers is the greater availability of places here. But that has led us to conclude that 25% figure now is largely composed of people who are determined leavers and are leaving by choice, and that is part of the reason we think it's stabilised. Looking into the future, trying to make some sort of speculative guesses on the impact of sort of current and recent circumstances. Another factor we've been looking at over the years is to try and identify if there is any evidence of the increase in the personal cost of entry to higher education in terms of the numbers or proportions of young people who are seeking entry into higher education. And so far, we're not seeing any evidence of that. We're not seeing any effect of the increase in the personal cost putting people off coming into higher education. But obviously this is a sort of dynamic situation and may change. There was in some of our work in the past the sense that although it may not put people off, it might have an effect on retention figures. And that once young people are in higher education and start to accumulate debt, they might at some point bail out rather than see the process through. But our most recent evidence suggests that this is very closely linked to the premium which young people identify as coming from having a degree. And it's that payoff, in a sense, that makes the cost, the personal cost, worth it. And that obviously raises the question that if that payoff at the end is seen to be reduced, then that might change decisions at the entry stage. And in the most recent work we did, we wondered whether or not massification might lead to a reduction in graduate premium and therefore have a knock-on effect on the willingness to bear the personal cost of going into higher education. Since that report was published, and it's not that long ago, the entire economy of the globe has been turned on its head, and that potentially is going to change things as well, because we know generally in an economic recessions that people run to educational qualifications in order to gain accreditation as a way of trying to get out of the process. So that might act as a countervailing pressure. Then on top of that, there's always the issue of whether or not there will actually be alternatives to higher education in any case because of the decline in the labour market generally. So this is one of these situations where there's a number of different things coming on, and we'll have to do later work to see what actually is happening. Thanks.